Hey, Rocketeers. I'm Laura Swisher, senior producer here at Max Fun. We wanted to give you a trigger warning for this episode of Pop Rocket. The panelists will be talking about movies from the 80s and rape culture and assault. You may want to sit this one out if hearing this kind of discussion is likely to do more harm than good.
Oh, hey there. I'm Margaret Wappler, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are my sorority sisters.
Hey!
Hi!
Digital strategist Winter Mitchell-Rohrbach.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. How are you?
So great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Delicious.
It's October, my favorite month.
It is a great month in LA.
It's a great month.
Rocktober.
Rocktober.
And we also have pop culture scholar and dyke about town. Oh, I love it when I get to introduce you this way. Karen Tongson, otherwise known for this show as the Tongs.
Hey, Margaret. Hi, Rocketeers.
And though we couldn't get PJ or Squee to come out, we do have actor, writer, and comedian Ted Alexandro. Hi, Ted.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you here.
Yes, yes.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. I know that you have made some comments lately on Louis C.K. and his unfortunate return.
Yeah, yeah. I did comment on that from the Comedy Cellar stage, as a matter of fact.
Do you want to live in a world where a man can't politely ask a colleague if he can take off all his clothes and masturbate to completion? Are we in that? Is that where we are as a culture? In the most gentlemanly of terms, may I please take my dick out and ejaculate in the workplace? Is that where we are?
Yeah, I felt like that was the place to do it. You know, I'm a comedian, so why not try to mine it for comedy?
Was it the 9 show or the 11?
I'm going to get McNeiler right now.
It was both, as a matter of fact. Yeah, I was going for it. So yeah, I did it the week that he came back, his initial return, and so I just decided to kind of put that out because talking to a bunch of comedians, they were like, you know, this... maybe you should put this out because maybe it'll resonate, in the larger discussion. I was hesitant to because I didn't know if like
they were setting you up.
Well, yeah, that. But I wasn't so much concerned with that as just like, is the material ready?
Am right.
I,
yeah.
You know, because it's something that where you're trying to hit a target that's kind of small. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I decided to, and I think it did resonate. So I was.
Now,
happy.
That's an engaged audience. I love going to the Comedy Cellar. I know I'm going to be entertained.
And make me think.
Make me
say something that's going to be interesting.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing about the Cellar is there's a lot of different comedians there, a lot of different styles. Mm-hmm. So I've been there long enough that I feel comfortable like exploring stuff, even if it's a little kind of not fully formed yet.
Yeah.
Like when I was younger, I would do that at other clubs and then only do like the A material at the Cellar because you're kind of always scared at the Cellar.
Yeah. Like,
but I've luckily reached the point where, I feel comfortable exploring whatever I'm working on. So this particular set, like I said, was kind of an exploration of Louis, but within the larger context of Me Too and Kavanaugh, even Cosby, all the things that are going on. So it was more of a macro look, even though like some of the articles that were written about the clip were like, comedian slams Louis, which was, you know, they like to make it that dynamic.
They got to get the clicks.
But that was, I think, a part of the story, a big part of it, because it was at the Cellar.
And also, who cares? Because he has no power anymore.
I mean,
that's like, kick out.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Bye. Yeah,
but
I mean,
what was the reaction from people? I mean, not only Vulture or wherever, but just regular people that you might have run into.
I would say overwhelmingly it's been positive. Mm-hmm. You know, people saying thank you for putting that out there, like a perspective that hasn't really been, especially, again, from that particular stage as well.
And from a straight male, let's say.
Yeah.
Because a lot of his bros have raced to his defense. Mm-hmm.
Sure, yeah. And also the fact that I worked with him for a period of time. You know, I opened for him on his tour. So
you did.
There was a lot of dynamics that made it, personally.
It gives you more authenticity because you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I just felt, again, for the larger conversation, I was doing this material on stage, so I thought, why not put it out? And to your question, yeah, I think it did resonate with people. And there were of course, the bro types who were, you know, immediately defending Louis and all this type of stuff. But I'm less concerned with that and more concerned with the broader conversation.
Yeah. We're really excited to have you here, especially as our resident straight male, to explain some of these things going
such,
on.
Such a Pop Rocket rarity. Yes, no diss to Andrew T, but you know.
Right. Usually it's just gay and queer is the day up in here.
I was hoping you guys were going to explain things to me, but I'll do what I can.
We'll do a little
reporting
flow
to duty, sir.
Coming up on this week's show, we're traveling back to the 80s to check out frat boy party culture as it appeared in movies and TV at the time. Plus, we'll be each sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news have caught our attention this week. So, Winter, what's been on your mind?
Okay, so after the full-on slot of the Kavanaugh hearings, which was literally, I felt like I was in a jail for 24 hours.
For like 36 hours.
For 36 hours. So much that when Alan kept asking me what's wrong, I couldn't even articulate it. So I sent him a link to the GQ article that was how to talk to your female, you know, the women in your life about the Kavanaugh trial. And he literally broke it down in basics. After I sent it to him, like an hour later, I got a text that was like, "Hi, Winter. What's going on?"
Oh, Alan.
He's learning, but he did a good job with it. And I said this weekend, the time that I have this weekend to watch what I can watch, because I worked all weekend, I said, I'm gonna watch Nick and Jessica.
Keep it light and
throwback.
Fluffy.
Not when they got married. Oh, not yeah. Chicken of the Sea era, when they were Dukes of Hazzard breaking up.
Oh. Oh, wow. Okay.
I wanted to just lean.
You right. Dived into the wreck.
I dived into it. I said, I want some drama because I only have a little bit of time, but I want some drama that has nothing to do with me and also has to do with someone else and it has no consequence at all. Okay.
I mean, but that
to
album,
anything.
Solo, Soul-O came out of
that he was recording in like random shacks, yeah. Brown area, suburbs.
Yeah.
I watched Nick and Jessica, Dukes of Hazzard era, and I just wanted to go back to when people on reality shows had to talk to each other about their shit because they didn't have cell phones. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of that.
Yeah.
So they didn't have like
they couldn't
smart
even text
phones.
Each other. Some
no,
nasty shit.
No, like she was holding something up to her ear at one point. I looked away and I looked back and I was like, why is she holding her face like
it's
that?
It's like a sidekick.
It was a sidekick. I was wow. Like, this is, I know, this is so right? Ready. Welcome to Pop Rocket. I just wanted to watch the dynamic and I watched some when I got back from my business trip with Alan. He was like, I'm this dude in the background, which is like some random family member who was asleep at the club that Nick and Jessica and all of them dragged them out to.
A Lachey?
It was a Lachey or a Simpson mm-hmm. cousin. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to watch Nick and Jessica, and YouTube just has like, I love the way, I just want to give a shout out to YouTube. It's a bastion of like bullshit sometimes, but if you get like people curating content the right way,
yes.
It had like each episode like broken down by this one fan, like this is the episode where da 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 da, and it's just like nice little synopsis in the description space, and then it's the comments. And my favorite thing is to read the comments, because the newest comments are always kids that are like, did Family Guy bring you here or da 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 da, and then but then it's the kids who like are able to react to it in such a mature way about this is when she was sick of him. check, you know, 505. She was so done with him.
Yeah,
at this
the
point.
Wisdom of hindsight.
The wisdom of hindsight. And I just, and then watching the Dukes of Hazzard thing and knowing in the aftermath that like she hooked up with Johnny Knoxville on set,
oh,
and then
God.
She can't look Nick in the
I
eye.
That.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I was like, now that I know everything I know about this, and then I went down like a rabbit hole, like who she dated after the fact, and it was the John Mayer era where she dyed her hair for
oh,
neck.
Right.
And then it was, yes. So I was like, this
wow.
is perfect distraction.
Her and John Mayer, of course.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. Of course.
Right?
Yeah. Wait, what's she doing now? I have no idea.
She's pregnant with her third kid. She's a she's a billionaire in name because she has sold her name to I forget the guy's name, but he bought her out, and she has like all these materials that she sells, you know,
the QVC stuff.
Yeah, like Jessica Simpson stuff. And she's married to that former football player who only made it like less than a year on the 49ers.
But
either
way, that's all you need.
For that pension, I guess that's how it works.
Karen, what about you? What caught your fancy this week?
I took a different escape route, and it was, I think, like kind of basically shutting off all the different forms of visual culture around me, because I think that I was just like, my eyes were like sutured to so many screens just like watching this whole debacle unfold. And so I noticed that Christine and the Queen's newest album, Chris, just came out recently, and I was like, oh, I'm going to give this a listen. And, you know, you Rocketeers may recall that in the past 6 months or so, like the a couple of teaser tracks from that album were my jams. And lo and behold, all 22 beautiful tracks, 23 actually, because there's a bonus track, and 11 of those tracks are English versions of the songs and French versions of the song, because Christine and the Queens is not a whole band, but essentially one artist named Eloise Letizier. Right now, Eloise, a.k.a. Christine, a.k.a. Chris, is exploring other realms of gender fluidity, particularly, you know, the kind of more masculine realm of things. As I mentioned previously on one of the shows, like, she cut her hair off and is, like, you know, exploring a kind of level of butchness, and is also very much kind of openly pansexual. I think that she kind of ditched bisexual and queer and has just like gone the whole like I'm an electronic musician route. Anyway, the album is so good. It's perfect for nose to tail scarfing. I'm going to play a little clip for you right here. Now show me how you get to I'm alone. Come see some man. Something kind of so sonically delightful about the different layers that come into this album. It's, you know, a kind of electronic playground. Anything from, you know, your early aughts like Frou Frou, Imogen Heap, to a touch of like Annie Lennox, Medusa, and, you know, with all of that kind of joie de vivre that French pop tends to have.
Yeah.
So also I would highly recommend, if Christine and the Queens is playing in your town, go see her live, because of her backup dancers. Also, it's a great show. Anyway, if you need a sonic escape, if you want to be in the dance floor in your mind, listen to this.
Yeah. All right, Ted, how about you? What did you notice this week?
Well, I have to say, two things have been kind of my realm this week. One is my wife and I are celebrating our first anniversary.
Congrats!
Oh, Mazel Tov!
Thank you. So that's really... And
you dragged her to Pop Rocket tonight.
I dragged her, yes.
That's love. Yay.
So, which is really why I have to mention her. She is here, and she came out to L.A. for this entire week for me, because I'm promoting my new album, comes out Thursday, October 4th, and I've just been making the rounds promoting it and talking about, you know, this new album, Senior Class of Earth. And my wife is, you know, we're celebrating our anniversary week, and she's supporting me. And
aww.
And along the lines of what you guys were saying with all the Kavanaugh stuff, and, you know, it's just like, it's such a heavy time, and all of these things that come up and that we're constantly obviously discussing too. She is kind of my compass for so much of this, and so much of, like, she helps me process it, you know? So I'm so grateful, this week being such an important week for me on so many levels, to do it with my wife is, it just is making me happy. So
the first anniversary is so special. What's the actual date you guys got married?
October 7th.
Okay, I'm October 12th.
Oh, I'm October 4th. No, I'm not.
No.
You're August.
August, yeah.
Just want to join
it just
in.
Happened. I'm October 4th.
Well, for me this week, like a lot of you guys, I couldn't tear my eyes away from that insane Kavanaugh hearing. I didn't really plan on watching the whole thing, and I didn't exactly watch the whole thing, but I watched probably like 80% of it. And particularly with his testimony, if that's what you want to call it, Just the whipsawing between anger and partisan rage and entitlement and sobbing and how much he likes beer. I mean, it was
calendars.
Yeah.
Squee,
PJ, Tobin. I mean, I know these names now.
Tobin's Betamax.
Yeah, like they're my own Phi Kappa Beta Phi brothers or whatever. It was just a train wreck of judicial ill temper. And I think one of the things that finally made me laugh and let off a little steam about it all was SNL's cold open this week with Matt Damon, the very well cast Matt Damon, playing Judge Kavanaugh, with Kate McKinnon as Lindsey Graham. A.D. Bryant was the prosecutor Rachel Mitchell, the put upon Rachel Mitchell. They pulled out all sorts of people that they don't usually have on the cast anymore. Rachel Dratch was the senator from Minnesota. It was just
Klobuchar.
Really, yeah, Klobuchar. And it was really funny, really well done. And we have a clip here of Matt Damon.
First of all, I showed this speech to almost no one. Not my family, not my friends, not even PJ or Tobin or Squee. This is my speech. There are others like it, but this is mine. I wrote it myself last night while screaming into an empty bag of Doritos. I'm here tonight because of a sham, a political con job orchestrated by the Clintons and George Soros and Kathy Griffin and Mr. Ronan Sinatra. Now, I am usually an optimist. I'm a keg is half full kind of guy.
We'll be talking about kegs half full when we're back. You're listening to Pop Rocket.
I'm Bailiff Jesse Thorne, and justice is within your reach.
My mom refuses to take my phone calls.
My boyfriend says I should take our cats with me to graduate school, but I think he should keep them.
In the court of Judge John Hodgman, justice rules.
My partner's board game collection is out of control.
My sister won't stop stealing my clothes.
I'm Judge John Hodgman. I'm tough, but fair. I'll bring you justice, and I'm only a click away.
Tipping, automotive etiquette, siblings, roommates. If you've got a case, go to MaximumFun.org/JJHO. Judge John Hodgman is tough, but fair. Subscribe to the podcast today.
Judge John Hodgman rules.
That is all.
Welcome back to Pop Bracket. I'm your host, Margaret Wappler, and joining me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell-Rorba.
Karen Tongson.
And I'm Ted Alexandro.
All right, you guys. This week, mark the return of the sitcom Murphy Brown with a Hillary Clinton cameo and everything. Unfortunately, also low ratings for CBS. But we actually want to turn and look at a different influence from the 80s, one that's left a lot darker of a mark on our culture than Candace Bergen's empowered journalist single mom character. I'm speaking, of course, of 80s rom-coms and raunchy sex comedies, now in the news thanks to Brett Kavanaugh in his now infamous yearbook.
As high school students, we sometimes did goofy or stupid things. I doubt we are alone in looking back at high school and cringing at some things. For one thing, our yearbook was a disaster. I think some editors and students wanted the yearbook to be some combination of Animal House, Caddyshack, and Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which were all recent movies at that time. Many of us went along in the yearbook to the point of absurdity.
Kavanaugh mentions not just one, but three different movies from the era. And I think part of the reason he mentions those movies is because it is true that those movies had a huge influence on the way teenagers saw themselves at the time, partially because there just wasn't many movies for teenagers yet. We're now living in a time where there are all kinds of movies and TV shows made for teenagers, but that wasn't always the case. As we go into a lot of those different movies and shows, I want to talk about how rape culture, as it was depicted in supposedly our most goofball, innocent adolescent comedies, influenced a whole generation and how we thought of consent. Where's the line between culture that permits youthful experimentation, which we have to have, mistakes and all, and then a culture that's codified a certain degree of assault is simply the price a girl or boy or trans person might pay for attending a party and or having a few beers?
Skis.
I want to ask you guys, so what movies from the 80s stand out as giving you some kind of instruction, no matter how warped that instruction might have been, about how sex supposedly worked?
Private School. In Fast Times. I think Private School is a little bit more obscure, but you could maybe check it out. I've only ever seen it on a streaming service once, but it's a Phoebe Cates movie and Matthew Modine is in it, I believe. But Fast Times, definitely Fast Times, probably because it's a little bit more localized to California. And I just was under the assumption that girls are always in peril and that there is, you know, I always think about in Fast Times how Jennifer Jason Leigh's character, she gets, this better not be a spoiler alert, she gets pregnant.
Yeah, we're not doing spoiler alerts, you know, guys. These movies are 25 plus
years old. 30 years old.
Screw you. And it had a,
almost
it had
40 years old.
TV series. You know, her character gets knocked up and the guy is like, don't care. And then he starts trying to sell tickets to try to get her abortion paid for, and her brother and
what a gentleman. You know?
What a gentleman. Yeah,
that is 80s chivalry right there in a nutshell.
She told him during track.
Scalping some tickets.
You know, and Jim. So I just always felt like it really, you know, that entire movie, she's in peril like the entire time. She loses her virginity in the dugout. I'm sure that's a double entendre. She, you know, ends up trying to seduce Mark. I mean, she learned so quickly in that school year that she has to take agency for her sexuality. And the one guy that she thought she can, now she's learned the art of manipulation, is like, you're a nice girl, Stacy. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to really do this. And that, I have to say that, and like Spice Channel and Playboy, all of those things framed things for me. The good news is that like, Playboy and Spice Channel were always really more female friendly, but it's interesting that I'm more drawn to like lesbian porn because I like the fact that a woman are agreeing that we're gonna do stuff, because so much that I grew up with in the 80s was like men taking it. Well, taking
you came across like Mariel Hemingway in Personal Best, like probably also in that period of
time,
right, on TV or something like that. I mean, honestly, though, as somebody who was actually probably about an adolescent, I was, you know, born in 1973. So around the time that Fast Times came out, I was like 10, 11. And, you know, many of the 80s films for me basically told me that the onus was on me to lose my virginity as quickly as possible.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, one of the things about Fast Times at Ridgemont High, we can kind of see it through the lens of female empowerment now compared to some of the other films of that era, because there are girls like the Jennifer Jason Leigh character, Phoebe Cates, et cetera, who are like, you know, very much, you know, in control, supposedly, of like wanting to lose it, as opposed to having it be taken from them.
Right.
But in the end, I think, like, you know, upon further reflection, it was just sort of what you see is essentially like the perils of inhabiting that position of trying to be like,
posturing.
Of course, I'm 16. I totally want to lose it. But like, actually, you know, like, each of those sex scenes, especially featuring Jennifer Jason Leigh, especially when she loses her virginity, are so disturbing precisely for the level of disconnect that she, you
total
know, establishes in her eyes. And then it's like a song that I quite enjoyed and forgot the context of, that,
Somebody's Baby,
which is one of my jams, like maybe over the winter. And I'm just like, oh my God, she like, there's something sick and twisted happening here. And I'm not sure if that's like, there's some editorial or like kind of directing choices there that Amy Heckerling made to kind of undercut some of the usually kind of horndog teen stuff that's going on in there. But also like things like, I remember coming across Hard Bodies.
Oh my God, Grant Kramer.
Yeah, which was like also one of those, like, it's another one of those movies where just like, it's just, all I remember is like, horn dog teens.
Yeah.
And like everybody just trying to do it and get it over with. And so like for most of my adolescence into high school in the 80s, you know, I was just like, that's what you're supposed to do at parties. That's what the ethos is supposed to be. And you're supposed to capitulate.
Yeah.
And but that's
I will say to Karen's point, Cameron Crowe interviewed. He wrote the film Fast Times, and he interviewed and like embedded himself into high school. So this was actually stuff that was happening.
Yeah. Like a San Diego high school.
Yeah.
That's true. It's like a kind of journalist approach to it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about you, straight man?
On a hot seat. I mean, all of these movies definitely resonated. You know, I always had this kind of strange relationship with media and all of these messages, because on the one hand, I was the guy that was the protagonist of all these movies, the guy that was conquering, right, or sexually getting the girl or whatever. But on the other hand, I inherently knew that there was something askew that wasn't, it didn't resonate with me on that level. I knew something was like being sold to me. I couldn't articulate it as a teenager, you know, and going through puberty and stuff, you just, you know, maybe like to see boobs or whatever.
Yeah.
But the larger message of like, maybe the roles, the gender roles or what it meant, what was being sold to me about masculinity, I could feel it didn't jibe with me on some level. But as far as these movies, I mean, at the time, something like Animal House made me laugh. And, you know, but only in probably the last decade did I kind of revisit those things with a broader perspective of who's making the movie, who's, you know, who's the cast, who are the leads. How are women portrayed? Are there even women in it? If they are, you know, is it just a sexual kind of object? You know, so, a lot of those things, you know, obviously the Me Too movement has been a bit of a sledgehammer to so much of, so you can't see things the same way. But I think for me, it's been an ongoing process of realizing that kind of the ways that we're conditioned or socially engineered as guys, not to dismiss it, but there's a lot of that is part of entertainment, you know. So it's disturbing.
Did you feel any pressure to comport yourself in ways that you saw in those movies?
Yeah, because like friends would have toga parties, and you know, I mean, I can relate, not to put myself in the Kavanaugh camp, but I can relate to some of the things that are cultural, like these toga parties, beer, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Again, I was never like the bro-y kind of, you know, the ways that he talks about Squee and those guys. you know, I played high school basketball, but I went to practice and I went home. It wasn't like, that frat culture. I was just telling my wife the other day, I'm really glad that I avoided that. I don't know how I did it. I really don't know how. Maybe I was just like, you know, just
it's a lot of time.
My parents were. It is a lot of time, a lot of energy. I think my interests lied elsewhere, and my values lied elsewhere.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I always felt like watching those movies as a woman, the lesson that I really took away from them is that I was supposed to be easygoing and roll with anything that happened to me.
Be the cool girl.
Be the cool girl, absolutely. And that meant, you know, drinking a lot of beer, and that meant being cool with whatever happened sexually, even if it didn't feel consensual or above board. It's like you're just supposed to roll with it and just be one of the guys, in essence. And I think I already kind of had some of that mentality as like a person who grew up with four older brothers. I felt a lot of pressure to sort of behave in ways that they would find cool. But that was that. I feel like those movies sort of made it double down for me. But, you know, something else about those movies that I think is really interesting is that they all were packaged as like sort of innocent, good fun. Right.
Like
they're, they're romps. There was never supposed to be anything dark about a bunch of dudes drinking beer and getting girls.
I mean, honestly, though, like one of the things that in retrospect, you know, when we were like preparing for this episode, and I was just like, you know, I never liked Animal House. I
can't, never.
I can't put my finger on why. I never, never. Like in Caddyshack and Adam. I knew that as a person who was like into comedy and into fun things and into funny stuff, I understood like the toga reference.
Yeah.
But like those never sat well with me. I mean, as a young person, I was a child, you know, like a pretty, you know, I guess like, you know, under 10 when Animal House came out or whatever. But it's just like, but I couldn't remember why I didn't like them so much. And then, you know, having rewatched them, it's just sort of like, oh, okay, because, you know, because one of the two is just like, one of the most egregious things that is in Animal House is actually like when you see at the very end where they tell you what all the characters are up to in the freeze frame.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like, of course, John Belushi's character, Bluto, who's basically kind of monosyllabic, like grunting, like, fun, like gross guy.
He's always like a pre-verbal dude in these
like
movies,
he becomes a senator.
Like, can't even talk, who just like pours beer down his face.
Ogre
and
in Revenge of the Bluto.
That's great. That's such a great expression.
I mean, that's a great
His character, Bluto, becomes a U.S. senator.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Like, what? Immediately in the scene where you see him at the very end of Animal House,
where he
essentially, like, kidnapped, he takes one of the sorority chicks who he's been ogling the whole time and essentially kind of takes her in the car and, you know, like, by force, but then she just capitulates and consents, and then it says, like, you know, Blutowski became Mr. and Mrs. Blutowski, like, in the U.S. Senate, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that is the fundamental truth of how all this shit turns out.
Yeah. And that is the underlying message that they can behave however the hell they want in college. Like, college
or high
was,
school is college.
Yeah, high school. Yeah, it was like this open time, like the Rumspringa that all these guys get to have where they get to drink and just be crazy but still get funneled into wonderful, high-paying jobs and get, you know, nice women to marry them and have their babies.
I mean, it's interesting you bring that up because they did an SNL skit like that. Mm-hmm. That was in this week's episode, the Adam Driver episode, where they showed people at a frat party and then showed the postscript, like what they'd become in the future. I mean, that movie framed this entire episode this week, the season opener of SNL. And the one thing that I think about, like I think about 16 Candles, I think about Pretty in Pink. There's the classism.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know what
For
I mean?
Sure.
Like you're hot. And you will get a hot, rich dude. You're set up for life. You're poor, Andy, and you got to make your own prom dress. And you can only date, like,
Her
vaguely.
Dress was not very nice, let's be honest.
You said that before.
I know.
Like, year one.
Yeah,
and I love the shit out of that dress, okay? I love Andy's prom dress.
Original Pop Rocket beef here.
I love that dress. I'm going to reload my guns like Henry Cavill on that. Then there, I think about, like, you know, when we talk about Revenge of the Nerds, if we're going to like college experiences, I didn't go to college. I'm a high school dropout. But what I think one of the reasons I'm a high school dropout is because I didn't want to get into more shit. And these movies sort of really show that you're constantly having to deal with a gang community of people, and they're all factioned off, and it's like being in a mini city in a smaller space. And Revenge of the Nerds, you know. Looking back, I loved that movie, but it's problematic.
Oh yeah,
it's hugely problematic. There's forget the racism. We're not talking about racism today because there's a lot of like you know racial stuff that's not really toned
but I do
in there.
Think
but
they're
the
related.
Sex,
they're all linked together.
Right? They're all linked together.
Yeah. Well, I want to tee up Revenge of the Nerds a bit more because a bunch of us rewatched it, and you've seen it too,
I've
right,
seen
Ted?
It,
yeah. And I think that the Revenge of the Nerds is particularly interesting to look at this time because it does set up the anticipation that nerds would eventually become the cool guru bros of the world. That these nerds in the movie, we know now looking back that they're going to be future tech titans and startup bros and all the rest of it. So it has another layer to it beyond just the sort of like sexual and racial politics present there. But one of the most disturbing aspects of Revenge of the Nerds, of course, is a scene between Lewis, sort of one of the head nerds played by Robert Carradine, and Betty, who is played by Julia Montgomery, and she is from the kind of popular girl sorority. And we see them have non-consensual sex, otherwise known as rape. Lewis basically removes the mask that he's wearing after he has sex with her. She thought it was her boyfriend. She thought it was her jock boyfriend, and it wasn't.
You're that nerd.
Yeah.
God, you are wonderful.
Thanks.
Are all nerds as good as you?
Yes.
How come?
Because all jocks think about is sports. All we ever think about is sex.
Oh, boy. it should be also mentioned that Betty and Lewis are married in Revenge of the Nerds 2. So,
oh, yeah, Nerds in Paradise, baby. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but that's what I meant by the word capitulate. It's just like you have to roll with whatever happens.
Yeah, I do think that in most of these movies, and definitely Revenge of the Nerds, like you as a man are supposed to seize the day sexually. Like right. If you see a way to pull one over and get away with it, which you always get away with it, then you should do it. Like the moment that Lewis sees Betty going into the funhouse across the carnival and basically decides to follow her and pull the fast one on her, it's like you see the moment, you see it click in his eyes that he can do this.
Yeah,
we're supposed to think that he's being a real like masculine self-starter because he's like going in after her and taking control, so to speak, of the situation.
He just red-pilled her.
Yeah,
and there's almost like no wrong that you can do, you know, like because the situations that you've outlined are bad, and like you said, it is essentially kind of, it's rape if you're wearing a mask and then reveal that you're not the person that she thought you were, even as absurd as that is. But yeah, they feed you these scenarios that essentially give you license to, like, anything's within the bounds of fair play kind of sexually as long as you get laid. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was interesting the word capitulate because it's even like beyond capitulate in the sense that like two of the things that we were talking about, the Blutarsky woman, she doesn't just capitulate. They live happily ever after.
Yeah.
Right. And you said in the Revenge of the Nerds, they wind
get
up
married.
Getting married. So it's like, yeah.
You get rewarded.
Yeah. Yeah. It's toxic. You know, the message is that, and that's what's so interesting about kind of bro culture now in the Kavanaughs of the world. You see them railing against. What is everything I've been taught a lie? Like we were just having our skis and
it was a good time. We're at the UB40 concert.
Yeah,
it was all a good time. Yeah, and they were, you know, they had no awareness that these things were wrong.
No, to me, it's because the internet showed up.
Yeah,
it's the internet showed up, and the internet.
Well, women showed up, right? Because of the in the sense that
right,
there's a voice. There's a voice
there
that
was a voice.
Yeah,
you know, we weren't in zines and on Playboy, and I really feel like if we hadn't had the dawning of the internet, and I'm not saying this because I'm a digital strategist, I'm saying it because it's fucking true. If we didn't have the internet. And we didn't have a voice to put to our anger or pain or elation or excitement. They weren't paying attention to Black women, Hispanic women, Latin women, Filipino women, you know, married women, single women. They weren't pregnant women. They weren't listening to them. They were looking at hot blondes doing their thing. And that's all we were shown. I mean,
those blondes were so essentially like... up for anything, right? Like, including like the top sorority sisters in all of these movies that take place in college,
right?
That take place within the Greek system. It's like, you know, they're opportunists who are willing to hitch their wagon to anybody, right? And that's supposed to say something about like that kind of, I don't know, trophy femininity or something. Whereas like the Omega Moos of Revenge of the Nerds,
they
right?
were
like,
they have a different dance to Thriller.
They had like there's like a whole different, you know, there were different
Lambda,
range of
Lambda, Lambda.
Well, the Omega Moos
Omega
are
Moos.
The sorority.
Oh, I see.
That with the lady nerds.
Yes.
Yeah, with the accordion.
I loved all the lady nerds.
Like, Omega
Moose. I was like, and they showed up to the party on time and in a line.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm going to hang with these girls.
But can I ask a question? Like, John Cusack, he was sort of the anomaly. And even Andrew McCarthy in the Rat Pack, there was an anomaly. There was the guy who was like, I'm sensitive.
Yeah.
And right. and John Cryer. Mm-hmm. I'm sensitive. I am not trying to push you onto the bed. It's awkward for me. It's I actually really deeply love you, and I listen to albums about you. I mean,
and I'll play that album outside yeah. your house
exactly.
on a cassette.
But exactly.
Their sensitivity meant, though, that they like that encouraged a whole other level of like stalking. You know
yes.
what I mean?
Well, that, so that far encouraged as, the like right. emo boy the to emo basically boy, cross all kinds of boundaries because he felt the emotion.
It's like, you know, the straight line from Lloyd Dobler to The Notebook. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where it's just like, oh, you won't date me? I'm gonna line the street and get like run over by a car or whatever. You know? It's just sort of like. And that kind of, you know, that also presents, like, that high romance of things also presents, like, a really kind of limited range. It's, essentially, it's another version of aggressivity, right? I mean, and there's one more thing that I wanted to bring up in relation to, you know, the conversations about 16 Candles mm-hmm. and about, you know, Jake's girlfriend who essentially gets passed off, right?
Right. Passed
between men.
To have fun with.
And the thing is, like, one of the things I noticed from rewatching these movies is that women essentially are transactional objects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just sort of like, it's there to facilitate a kind of either male bonding ritual or to demonstrate the magnanimity of one guy over another. I mean, and then when you think about, like, the allegations against Brett Kavanaugh and, like, you know, he was supposedly in that room with another guy,
yes.
Mark Judge. And, you know, the fact that there were two of them there, it's all about, like, you know, let me show you, let me prove to you. Like, it's yeah. as much about, like, what's happening between those two men, right?
Having a witness, too, right?
Yeah, like, it's about, like, having a witness. It's also, like, just, you know, it's about, like, proving your masculinity. And, like, in many respects, then the woman just becomes an object. She just becomes a non-entity in that situation. And that's kind of the, you know, that's sort of what that 16 Candles scene models, is that she's just this thing that you can kind of discard or transact, you know?
Yeah, well, I was struck in Revenge of the Nerds, too, about how the jockish fraternity and the nerd group never really butt heads directly. They do it all through the women. You know,
yeah.
they
yep.
use the women as pawns and tools to get back at each other.
Yep, yep, yep. I have one question
yeah.
or one thought. One, I can totally see in the Kavanaugh space how men learn to become this way because of the media. Okay, I hate to be like Dolores Tucker about this, but I'm starting to see the through line. But the other thing is that I'm trying to figure out, like, when men make these decisions at this point in their lives, they're sprung from a repression and it launched into this world
mm-hmm.
where they can do whatever. I look at, I hate to say this because I would never tie those together, but I look at Brett Kavanaugh and I look at the situation and I go, Alan could have easily been Brett Kavanaugh. He was raised to be, you know, when he was talking about his calendar, I was laughing because I was thinking about how Alan was like, I was in the gym two times a day. I would go out and party with my friends. I would go back to study for school. I got a full scholarship. I didn't have to do anything. I was all American, all state. And it's just like, I was like, you could have easily been this guy. You could have easily been this guy, but you were trained and told and asked
yeah.
to be this person because the community insisted on it.
Right. I mean, I think that is like the question that's on everyone's minds in a way, is like, how much did this kind of culture enable people to
yeah.
do these kinds of things?
Right.
And to write it off as just rites of passages and
right.
part of being a teen boy.
And not just rites of passage, but rights. Right? Like, it is within my right. It's my right to become a Supreme Court justice.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what I did when I was 17.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I think, again, like, what you were alluding to with the voices of women showing up, I think, you know, had this trial taken place pre-internet,
yeah.
it probably would not, you know,
I
it wouldn't be a blip.
It would be Anita Hill trial.
It would be Anita Hill, right?
Yeah.
So, like, for this, again, to see this guy who embodies all of the things we're talking about, who essentially believes himself to have done everything right. You know,
yes.
like, I just kind
yes.
of claimed, I claimed what was mine.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And now you're holding me to account, like, to a standard that was never
How
present.
How dare you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can see where he's coming from, but it's obviously all wrong.
Well, keeping in mind his rank, entitlement, and love of beer, which villain or other character from these teen movies would you say Brett Kavanaugh is most like?
Oh, good question.
I mean, because I just saw Animal House and its outcome, Blutarsky. You know, I mean, the thing is, though, Bluto didn't have good grades, right? So that was one of the things.
We don't know that he did either. We have no verification.
Well, it got into Yale.
Well, you know, it was like
so did George Bush. George W. Bush.
That's right. That's right. Well, he might have been a hybrid of who was the other guy in Animal House who was kind of well coiffed, kind of buttoned down.
Oh, the president,
the head of the right.
Yeah,
yeah. Maybe he was a mix of Blutarsky.
I think a little bit of that. Yeah, right. I think that there is just like this sense of like you got to do what you need to do, right? Mm-hmm. And then like because he becomes that character becomes like a district attorney, or like a public defender in Baltimore or something like that or whatnot. But like, but essentially all of the characters from the Delta House and Animal House end up in like positions of power. Even Tim Matheson's character becomes a gynecologist in Beverly Hills.
Of course he does.
Which, you know, he like, and he's a notorious womanizer, which, you know, teaching at a university where there is a tremendous scandal that like people are coping with a gynecologist who assaulted hundreds of people.
But we're talking about National Lampoon.
Yeah.
If you've ever read anything about National Lampoon,
yeah,
these are supposed to be the most brilliant minds because they went to Harvard.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
But they're all, I'm not even going to go there.
No, you're right.
We already know.
Yeah.
We already know. But, like, he's 100% a Steph McKee. Mm-hmm. Like without the
from
jock,
where, from what
that's
movie?
From Pretty Pretty
Steph
and Pete.
From Pretty Big Spader.
James Spader.
That's
character.
What I was gonna say too.
He's
I think
Steph
there's
McKee.
Like,
but he without the jockey of it, just like
that's
Mary,
a good hair.
Yeah,
but James Spader in that movie is an ice cold biatch.
Biatch.
But when halfway, you see his feathers get ruffled, that's when you see the Brett Kavanaugh.
And that it to me is like half he without the jock because this is the thing that I'm observing marrying a white jock. Like they have, there's a jockiness to them that comes out depending on what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Where they have to, it's innate. It's like in their genetic makeup that they have to show their aggression. Mm-hmm. And it comes out in different places. With Alan, it's like traffic or being inconvenienced for the eighth time in like a 3 hour span, which doesn't obviously happen because his wife is a fucking power bitch. But it's like there's the Steph McKee of it all, it's the entitlement.
Yes.
That's what I saw in Kavanaugh during that entire thing that I had to step out of my bedroom and sit in my living room and put the volume on full blast because I couldn't look at this dude anymore.
Right.
You're so entitled. Like you need to. And then his parents being prosecutors, but it's just the entitlement. And I think that's what when I look at like, you know, from Animal House on down, these 80s bro movies, the Chevy Chase interview. The Chevy Chase interview where he's just like, these guys suck. He hasn't worked in years.
Disaster. And he's not going to now.
He's not going to now. And the fact that he's offended by Donald Glover having so much sex. Sorry. He's offended by Donald and sex. But he's offended by Donald Glover having so much success after him supposedly being the star of this show because he's used to entitlement. And I was raised on this culture. I love Chevy Chase growing up and now I can't look at the guy and these guys were positioned and propped up as the movie star and the marketing and the engagement and the amount of press and covers and you know I feel bad that I was fed so much of this stuff that it's colored my it's colored my entire interest in comedy and stand-up and anything like that because I watched these guys SNL and these guys suck.
Yeah, I mean, Chevy Chase is angry. And speaking of anger, I just want to indulge real quick a revenge fantasy that I have on behalf of Caroline from 16 Candles. I hope just connecting her name to another famous Caroline or Carrie, I hope she pulls a full-on Carrie in just the alternate universe and just burns down the whole high school with just her gaze, just looking out at
like
all
Veronica
of them. Yeah, just
from
puts
Heathers.
Them all into flames. That's just the way I feel. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, everybody. This is J. Keith Van Stratton, host of Go Fact Yourself, a live game show here on the Maximum Fun Network. On Go Fact Yourself, we take the smartest people we know and make them look dumb.
Oh, by the way, how much do you know about chicken husbandry?
You gotta give them that grain.
All right.
You gotta give them that grain.
And then smart again.
What future Hall of Fame pitcher for the Cleveland Indians became the first active player to enlist?
Bob Feller.
Oh, okay.
We've got me, co-host Helen Hong, plus celebrity guests and actual surprise experts.
All right, we have an expert on hand who can tell us for sure.
Is it Alan Avey?
Helen, who do we have tonight?
Alan Havey!
Alan Havey!
In the coming weeks, you can hear guests like Maria Bamford, Tom Bergeron, Paul F. Tompkins, Janet Varney, and Grant Imahara. Check us out on the first and third Friday of every month here on the Maximum Fun Network.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Margaret Wappler, and joining me in the studio are my girls,
Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh
and Karen Tongson,
and my straight man,
Ted Alexandro.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask the panel a very special question. Karen, can you tell me what that question is?
It is, what is your jam?
Yes. So, Karen, on that note, what is your jam?
My jam is nowhere near resembling the terrible accent that I just produced for you. It's actually a jam that took me by surprise. It's a song that when I first heard it, I thought, this is serving me some Ani vibes. Mm. Who is this? It turned out it was Selena Gomez.
And literally the last person I thought you would name.
Well, it's Selena Gomez, and it's her song, Back to You. I know I'd go back to you. I mean, when you hear that, like even that little rolling drum fill, it's very Ani's Out of Range or like the Dilate album. And then it kind of like toggles over into that like Bieber-esque like.
Because it's always got a touchdown on Bieber somewhere.
It touches down on that Bieber-esque like, you know, that kind of weird instrument in the back of that thing.
Right.
Right. I don't even know what
he
to
coined
call
that.
It.
His weird, like, only contribution to pop music is that.
I think of it as the millennial pan flute.
Yeah. Yes. It is the millennial pan flute, exactly. Yes. Anyway, I really dig this song. I mean, I guess it came out all the way back in May. It's on the 13 Reasons Why soundtrack season 2. And frankly, the music video is also amazing because it's definitely an aspirational song. The video is inspired by the 1965 French New Wave film,
what?
Pierrot Le Feu.
Oh, look at how cool she is.
Look at what she's up to. She's giving you Ani, like, auditorily, and then visually, like, a little, French New Wave.
Nice. All right, Winter, what about you? What's your jam?
I love Lil Wayne, and I've loved him from afar because I've been consumed by what I thought was music for the last 20 years, obviously. And I never really paid attention to him because I felt like he went commercial.
Yeah.
But he went commercial in a way that doesn't, like, he pandered, not to, to my opinion, he pandered too much to, like, skater kids. So I couldn't, like when he first came out and debuted when he was 14, it was very much like Gully.
Oh my God, he was that young?
He was. It was like 90, he's like only maybe a year younger than me. So or maybe 3 years younger than me. I was definitely like 16 or 17 when he blew up. Mm-hmm. And he was 14 years old. So he comes out with this album and then he starts, you know, working with the Hot Boys and Birdman and all those different guys. And he's always been gifted and talented and just great at it. But then somewhere between the first Carter and Four and every little mixtape in between, I was just like, whatever, don't care. Well, he's dropped the Carter Five after a long...
Yeah, I was going to say it's been a long
It's been about 5 years. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to actually give in to the bullshit. And just see what happens. And the bullshit is good. It's not even bullshit. It's one of the better albums that has dropped this year. And everybody has been blowing up releases and nothing has been great. And this is a release that I'm actually happy about because it actually has refolded me back into his fan base and his camp. In particular, this song, Uproar. The reason I love this song, besides his flow, and it which is great, and one of the other reasons I love his album is because it's just sticking to music and little intricate things. And it's not going heavy. Everybody's trying to answer to something, and he's just rapping. That is still my favorite love quote. Put the gun aside. What the fuck for? I sleep with the gun, and she don't snow. What the fuck, yo? Where the love go? Trade the ski mask. I
like that he gives a shout out to the person who originally produced the beat, which
is Swizz Beatz. Yeah. Well, you know, it's reminding me that I saw Lil Wayne in like 2004, 2005, something like that, when he was like really at the top of his game.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the way he was like the most effortless rapper I've ever seen.
It's breathless.
Like Jay-Z is like laboring, you know, like you can see the labor. And I'm not even saying that to like shade him or anything, but it's just a different
Jay-Z's
thing.
Jay-Z's almost 50.
Yeah. But like, yeah, Lil Wayne's his child.
Yes.
And he like was just seriously just tossing it off without breaking a sweat.
Yeah.
Do we know what his current relationship is with the Scissoro?
With the lean?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to assume that he's leaned off the lean.
I hope so.
Because lean is not good for you.
No, it is not. Keep healthy, Lil Wayne.
Keep healthy. Keep healthy.
So, Ted, tell us about your jam.
My jam is Jamiroquai, Virtual Insanity. Just because I was in a cab recently in Vegas, an Uber, and that song came on, and I just, myself and the driver got into this extended conversation about that song, about how kind of prescient it was. It kind of almost describes the time we're in now, the insanity of it, and technology, and the distractions. So yeah, it just kind of, to me, it resonated. You know how songs kind of, I mean, they hit you at different times in different ways.
Yeah.
But just in that moment, being in the car with this guy, we must have had about a 15-minute conversation on, first on the song, but then on society, jumping off onto it.
Yeah. Oh, wow. These are my favorite Uber rides, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Such a different like sense
era.
Of optimism, you know, like a different sense of time and optimism.
Were you stoked he was at Coachella? Because I was stoked and I wasn't even there.
I did not know he was.
Oh, well, Ted. Well. He was there.
He was in my cab.
He was in your cab.
Virtually,
Virtually.
But can any of us actually recall Jamiroquai's face? Because
I thought he was black.
Yeah.
But he's white.
Yeah, everyone thought he was white.
Yeah. I thought he was American and he's British, right?
He thought he had dreads, but it's not.
Yeah.
But, you know, also, I have a very...
He's an enigma wrapped in a mystery, wrapped in dreads. I have a very strong
Jamiroquai memory, and that is that he was a guest on one of Jamie Oliver's cooking shows where, like, he was cooking with Jamiroquai.
But did he have an oversized sweatshirt and baggy pants? He's living his life.
My jam this week is from No Name, who is a Chicagoan rapper. She's transplanted herself to LA recently. Her real name, she does actually have a real name, is Fatima Warner. And she's fiercely independent. She's been financing her own recordings and videos. And she came out really recently with her new album, Room 25. This is Self, the opening track.
Maybe this is an album you listen to in your car when you're driving home late at night, really questioning every guy, religion, Kanye bitches. Maybe this is an entrance before you get to the river, a heaven before the heathen, no reason for you to like me. Maybe this your wife, he just went in a clean divorce. The baby ain't really yours. It's really for baby's teeth and a chicken.
I love how casual she is and super chill, but when you're really listening, you can hear how much she packs in, all these references and free associations and thoughts that really take you like several listens to dive deep into. And all the like jazz and R&B that's just flowing through it is really beautiful. So check out her new record, Room 25.
That's a very good song to vape to.
Yeah, it is.
Or like, you know, maybe have a little nip of an edible.
Indeed. And you could take a nice, good drag to that song, exhale it, and still keep right in that rhythm. So if anybody wants to try it at home, now's the time. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Margaret Wappler, with Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh and Karen Tongson and Ted Alexandro. Ted, tell us where we can find you online.
Well, you can find me at Ted Alexandro on social media. TedAlexandro.com, and most importantly, my new special, Senior Class of Earth, is available at ATCSpecials.com. That's all things comedy, ATCSpecials.com, my new hour special.
And soon Netflix.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Soon.
Do you have any live shows coming up?
Yeah, I'm actually touring with Jim Gaffigan, so we're kind of all over the place.
He's a safe person.
He's very safe. I love Jim. Yes.
We like
him. Please don't crush him for me.
Absolutely. We do like him.
Yeah, we like him.
Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. At last, you guys were sleeping on it for a while, but
I mean, you know, listen to Margaret's vim and vigor.
Yeah,
that's
right?
Thanks to you.
Yeah, I feel like I've been taking apple cider vinegar shots all day or something. This week, we'd like to thank E. Ripley, who says, "Ashamed to say it took me so long to get into Pop Rocket, but so happy to be here. Happy to have you here." Susanna, "If you take the level of scrutiny the Best Buy payphone receives in season one of Serial and apply it to Rachel Bloom's body of work, you got Pop Rocket." That's nice. I like that.
I like it.
Albert and Nina, "Perfect balance of mirth, fluff, and insight. Like the perfect candy that has something savory to cut the sweetness, Pop Rocket combines both frivolous pop culture with smart analysis and insight, so it's entertaining and informative."
Sea salt. It's like sea salt with chocolate.
That's right. Beauty School Knockout says...
That's enough. That's a good one. That's a
yeah.
good one.
But yeah, we need to save that in the pile of good avatar names. "I have found my people. These are the popular culture conversations I crave. I want Guy to be my sister, Karen to be my professor, Margaret to be in my book club, and I want Winter to be my coach. Love these hilarious, brilliant people so much."
Aww.
Thank you, Beauty School.
Welcome, Beauty School Knockout.
Get
number one on the list.
Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or find us on Instagram at Pop Rocket Podcast, or join our Facebook group where we're always having amazing discussions. We're a production of MaximumFun.org. The show is edited by the absent Shayna Deloria and our beautiful senior producer, Laura Swisher.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.